John Grierson, and I couldn't be more pleased to be part of the Celtica team. So, hooray for this medium, which allows real freedom of speech and is not regulated by Ofcom. Now, I don't intend to be fair, but I will try to be honest. Someone else wants to put an opposite point of view, or you want to comment in general, go ahead. Email me, and the address is john@celticaradio.com. That's john@celticaradio.com. In future, I'll string together four or five different subjects and muse my way through them, but for these first two episodes, I'm going to concentrate on just one subject because it's dear to my heart, I think it's important, and I also hope it might be helpful. I'm going to talk about the painful, wasteful, and needlessly cumbersome process of applying to Ofcom for a local radio license in the light of my decades of involvement with commercial radio and in the light of my own recent experience and observation. Celtica Radio has given me the opportunity to talk to people who are like myself, really, and who want to get involved with local radio because they're passionate, and I mean really passionate about it. I'm going to set out several things you should not be doing to help you avoid some of the traps. By the way, if you're not chasing a radio license, I hope you find this interesting anyway, because as a member of the British public, you ought to know something about a process being employed in your name. Let me make something crystal clear right from the off. I'm not some sort of English gent brought up to believe that taking part is more important than winning. I've tried very hard throughout my life to avoid going into competitions I knew I couldn't win. That just wastes time and money and effort. When I lost the Cornwall license earlier this year, I did so under circumstances which left me very, very angry, because Ofcom made a decision which was and is unfair, unreasonable, and perverse. Ofcom will say, it didn't. It didn't do that. And, of course, it now has the backing of a High Court judgment to rely on. I'm afraid that changes nothing in my mind, and I'll explain that later. Let me make something else plain. I'm not trying to make a case for getting rid of regulation of the radio spectrum altogether. There's always been a need for some form of rationing to avoid a free-for-all. But that's another matter for another time. I want to talk to people who still have the energy, the personal commitment, and the sheer determination to try for local commercial radio licenses in the face of what must be, and you'll soon discover why, overwhelming odds. I'm not interested in what the large radio conglomerates think. They've got little to lose, no matter how much money or time they pour into license applications. They bounce from one application to the next one, and if they lose, they simply move on to the next one after that, write off the costs against tax, and end of story. No. I'm interested in what you, the committed and passionate individual, and your local colleagues might be thinking, because your thoughts might be taking you in the wrong direction. Equally, I'm not very interested in what does or does not happen in what Ofcom calls the larger markets. And by that I mean, and they mean, the cities or towns or the regional licenses. Those licenses will always go directly to one of the big groups. My thoughts apply mainly to the smaller, local license areas where properly local radio belongs and has a job to do. So here goes. First of all, if you feel the urge to write a letter of intent to Ofcom because you want to stake a first claim, by all means go ahead. But don't specify too much. Make it very, very vague, because if you do go in any particular direction in terms of programming content or general policy, you'll be painting yourself into a corner. More about that a little later. And remember that getting what you know is the first such letter into Ofcom will not help you at all when it comes to the competitive application process. And even if you were not the first, but you do all the real work to get the regulator to consider a new license for your area, that won't help you either, so don't expect it. Next, do not bother with RSLs, Restricted Service License Broadcasts. There's no requirement for RSLs to be run, and if you do them, Ofcom will take not much, if any, note of what you may or may not have achieved. Certainly don't bother with researching your audience to any RSL you run if you do insist on running them. And while on the subject of RSLs, don't assume there's any need to link what you've been doing with your RSLs to the application you eventually make. If you run, say, 4 RSLs targeting a youth audience, and then you decide at the last minute that applying for a youth-orientated station will be a dead duck, don't worry about it too much. Change horses immediately. Ofcom won't care. Next, don't get into this race for the license too soon. It'll do you absolutely no good to spend years drumming up local support, doing presentations and holding meetings, sending out leaflets. Just go easy on all that stuff. Ofcom is not seriously interested because the only kind of evidence they want to see has got to come from research. And by that, they mean large sample, attitudinal and similar surveys, conducted as close as possible to the application deadline. Do you think that you can depend on support from the local area because Ofcom says it'll take that into account? Forget it. When Ofcom says support, or evidence of support, they mean evidence from research. Forget that at your peril. Now, when it comes to research, there must be someone in your area who's got some experience in radio or audience research or possibly both, and provided you give him or her a decent piece of the shareholding in your company, you can save a lot of money. But hang on, you say, such a person would then surely be part of your application team. And surely it wouldn't look right to have your own survey managed by your own people. It looks a bit, I don't know, suspect, doesn't it? And not really credible. Doesn't matter. Press ahead. Where does it say that research has to be independently managed and designed? As long as it supports your proposals and seems to have been put together by someone with at least some knowledge, you'll be okay. Oh, and by the way, quantity is much more important than quality when it comes to research. Make sure you do that one big survey, at least 850 respondents, and design the questionnaire so that the answers can do nothing other than support your proposals. But then do all sorts of other local stuff as cheaply as possible, like a couple of focus groups, a handful of approaches to very carefully selected potential advertisers, and anything else you can dream up. As I mentioned earlier, don't bother with spending money and time drumming up support from people by talking to them and listening to them. Make up for that by lots of little exercises which you then describe as research. Ofcom will lap it up. What about your consortium? First of all, avoid appointing as chairman of your board someone who Ofcom has never heard of. It's absolutely vital that you remember the British tradition of the great and the good being recognized and given the nod way ahead of anyone else. And the person you appoint to your board of directors has at some time been a media high flyer, that's perfect. If he's a chairman, ideal, you've got a head start. Ofcom knows them, and they know Ofcom. As to the rest of the board, gather as many people as you like, but be careful. Ofcom doesn't like to see overlarge boards of directors because they think this makes your applicant company unwieldy and incapable of making decisions. So appoint no more than, say, half a dozen people to the board of the applicant company itself and put all the rest into a limited liability partnership or even another limited company which lives alongside the main company. That company can have as many directors as you like. Well, you say you end up with about 14 people, all of whom have a de facto stake in the management and finances of the operation? Doesn't matter. Ofcom will buy that. What about shareholding? If there are too many individual shareholders, and this, by the way, is a common situation with small companies looking for radio licenses, so if there are too many, put most of them into that separate company I mentioned earlier. That separate company then holds a combined share in the license application company itself. Same number of people, same amount of investment overall, same spread of responsibilities. Does Ofcom object to this kind of tricky device? Nope, not in the least. They will actually applaud you for it. Before I leave the question of the shape and size of your company, here's another tip. Once you've decided who's going to serve on your application company board, and on the company off to the side if you have one, do not go to the bother of registering them at Companies House before the application goes to Ofcom. Just claim that they will be directors of your outfit. If you win the license, then you can register them. But surely the application advertisement asks who the directors of the company are, not who they will be, who they are. Doesn't matter. And you don't have to take my word for that, by the way. A High Court judge has said so. You can claim whomever you like as a director. Register them after you won the license, or don't. Makes no difference. You'll have dressed the window perfectly. Sounds like something out of Ripley's Believe It or Not? Believe it. Ridiculous, but true. Now we come to the wonderful business of income projections. Ofcom doesn't appear to understand very much about the way a truly local, small area radio station works. And in particular, it doesn't appear to understand where the vast majority of such stations' advertising revenue actually comes from. So because they don't understand, they demand that you produce a formula which talks about projected average weekly reach, about projected average hours, and based on that, what an advertiser will pay you for the time that you have for sale. Sounds familiar? Certainly does. That's the way advertising agencies work on behalf of the big national brand advertiser they represent. It has almost nothing to do with the way local advertisers and sponsors buy local radio. Local, and that usually means mostly retail businesses, buy radio time on involvement, on personal relationships with the salespeople and the presenters. They buy out of curiosity, out of interest, hoping for results through the till, and the thrill of being involved with the creative process of making commercials with the local station's help, on their customers stopping them in the street and saying, "Huh, heard your commercial on radio this morning. Really good." No, no. Far too unscientific. Not based on research. Ofcom cannot get its head around that. So it's the formula which counts and nothing else matters. So make sure that your formula is clear and show that by the end of year three or sooner if possible, you're bringing in enough income to start showing an operational excess of income over expenditure. Get the license, then throw this out the window and produce a set of proper projections for your own internal use. Incidentally, you could even submit a totally different set of projections to Ofcom after you won the license. No problem. Now, a very difficult question indeed. Big Brother, do you need a big radio company on board with you if you're going to win that license? Yes, you do. And unless you have a Big Brother partner, you don't stand a chance. But how big does Big Brother have to be? Well, not necessarily one of the really big monsters, but your Big Brother had better have at least a handful of other stations under its belt. And it doesn't matter if most of those stations are making no profit at all. As long as Ofcom can see that there's a safety net into which you can fall, a bit of cash provided by big enough investors somewhere in the background, they won't care if you turn out to have got your sums wrong, and at the end of your second year, say, your company would go bust unless it were pulled out of the fire by its Big Brother. So by the back door, the license is awarded not to you, but to the safety net which Ofcom needs to see. Ofcom will not even consider the possibility of failure. If you get that license, with the help of that safety net, you get it for life. Now, is there anything else you can learn from the way things have gone since Ofcom started to be responsible for commercial radio in the context of this Big Brother business? Certainly there is. The pattern is as clear as a bell. Do everything you can to have a press group on board, and the bigger the group, the better. You see, with very few exceptions, the licenses that have been awarded since December 2004 have been given to consortia where the press is a major player. Now, I can't be a hypocrite about this. My consortium in Cornwall had a press Big Brother because that seemed the sensible way to go. In any case, almost all of the major local and regional press players in particular have commercial radio divisions now, for obvious reasons. So Big Brother is almost invariably going to be a press conglomerate. So love them or hate them, you'd better get the press on board. Now, should you go to the trouble of nominating a general manager and a sales manager, or even nominate both of them as future board directors, on a confidential basis, of course, so that you're ready to hit the ground running the minute you're awarded the license? Don't waste your time. Ofcom is not interested. Simply inform Ofcom that a currently nameless station manager or managing director or launch director, describe him how you like, say that they'll be appointed in due course, and you don't even need to refer to a head of sales at all. Just make your promise of future action sound good. Now, while I'm on the subject of sounding and looking good, here's something else. Don't kid yourself that you can write a successful application document by keeping it simple and to the point. You think that's what Ofcom wants because they appear to say so in the application advertisement and elsewhere? Forget it. Find someone who can produce the most flowery language, using high-sounding phrases and promises wherever possible, and instruct that writer to pepper the application with as many graphs and charts as you can lay your hands on. It's probably not a good idea to allow the overall length to go beyond about 60 pages or so, but cram into those pages everything, including the kitchen sink. And then, by the way, if you're on the receiving end of supplementary questions after the application deadline, don't try to hold back on your answers in the interest of being brief as requested. Go right ahead and virtually submit a second application. The more explanation, the more verbiage, the better. Now, that's as far as I want to go for this part of the subject. In part two, I'll deal with the essential business of Section 105 of the Broadcasting Act, and I'll recount briefly what happened to me when I tried to get help from the High Court, because I felt that the award in Cornwall was unfair and perverse.
The fastest way to the internet.
islandwebservices.co.uk.
Island Web Services specialise in making effective and quick-loading websites for small businesses and organisations across the UK and beyond. We believe in giving everything a standard with no hidden extra costs. And you can get all this within a 12-page website from £370 sterling. Log on to find out more.
islandwebservices.co.uk.
Do you know that Celtica Radio has a fully functional outside broadcast unit? The unit has a drop-down stage and is able to sustain a live concert plus technical support staff. Our outside broadcast and roadshow facility is available for hire, and we have a successful track record of producing high-quality live output to augment your event. For further details, please contact sales@celticaradio.com. If you would like to know more, then why not have a listen to recordings of our live productions in both the programs and archive sections of our website. That address again is sales@celticaradio.com. Or telephone us on 07005 963770 and press option 2.
Welcome back to Celtica Radio. This is John Grierson with part 2 of my story on the licensing of local commercial radio. Now, I'm sorry to start off by sounding like a lawyer here. I don't mean to, but I want to make sure you understand this. Sections 105A to D of the Broadcasting Act 1990, as amended in 1996. This is the real core of the process, and Ofcom confirms it. Now, the Broadcasting Act has in fact been on the statute book since 1990, as I said, and even the Radio Authority was supposed to be assessing applications according to that statute. But Ofcom makes a really big deal out of it, so concentrate your fire on answering those requirements. However, and this is very important, when it comes to the requirements under 105C, where the law says Ofcom must assess how you propose broadening the choice of commercial radio programming, that's to say, commercial radio programming available to local listeners, be very careful. Whatever you do, don't be specific. Do not identify a demographic group or any group at which you intend to target your programming. You're at liberty to tell Ofcom that your new station will offer a broadening of choice by doing almost exactly the same thing as an existing station, and that the choice will take the form of competition between your new station and an existing one. Just use appropriate language here to make sure that you appear to be complying with Section 105C. But hang on, I can't be serious, can I? Surely Section 105C says exactly the opposite of that. Surely the purpose of the legislation is to offer local listeners something different. Well, you'd think so, but again, you don't have to take my word for that. Ofcom can completely turn this on its head. This question was tested in the High Court, and the same judge who declared that it's perfectly okay to claim directors who are not directors also said that direct competition under Section 105C is also perfectly okay. So 105C does not mean give local listeners a broadened choice by offering them a new kind of service at all. It just means offer to put a new radio station on the air. And if your application says it's going to produce almost exactly the same programming format as one already on the air, that's fine. And here's another wrinkle you should be careful to use. Make sure that the formal format promise you make is as short and as vaguely worded as you think you can get away with. If your format is terse but woolly and you win the license, you've got an ace in the hole. Let's say that in a year or so your business doesn't look so good and the problem is that the audience you decided to target are just not listening. No problem. Provided that your format is loose enough, you can switch your target to almost anywhere you like and start again. Even better if the existing station, which may have been around for a while, also has a format promise which is loosely worded. Ofcom says that either your new station or the existing one can then shift programming to target a different audience if either one of you finds you're too close to comfort to the other. But doesn't that defeat the whole purpose of a format? You'd think so, but again, this was tested in the High Court, and the judge said that this possibility of sliding about would be perfectly legal, perfectly okay, provided you've not stupidly committed yourself too tightly to a format which leaves no room to wriggle. Ofcom will give you, if you do it that way, it'll give you permission immediately to change. More stuff for Ripley's, believe it or not. Okay, so you've carefully tailored the requirements of Section 105C, which is supposed to broaden choice. But what about Sections A, B, and D? Let me dispose of B right away. It asks you to explain how you'll cater for the tastes and interests of the audience you propose to attract. Now, don't exactly avoid the question, but wrap up your answer in the most extravagant and ornate language you can manage. Make all kinds of deliberately vague and high-sounding promises, but commit yourself to as little as possible. Provided that your research generally endorses what you propose doing, the way you propose delivering the detailed programming counts for very little. And, by the way, you can ask for any promises you do make to be kept confidential. Now to Section D, Support and Research. Remember what I said earlier about research. Lots of it, little bites here and there, and one big overall survey. Ofcom is fixated on research, almost to the point where you begin to wonder if they've got some sort of interest in seeing that research companies make good profits. And by research, in small license areas, they do not mean expressions of support, even if they say they'll take both informal support and formal research into account, both of them. They'll concentrate all their attention on your formal research, with graphs and charts and percentages and as much arithmetical bull as you can cobble together. If you manage to get hundreds, or in the case of my application in Cornwall, thousands of letters and statements of support which have taken you a long time to gather, Ofcom will just sniff at that, and if they behave as they did in Cornwall, they will simply brush it aside. It's happened elsewhere with licenses they've awarded, so my advice is this. Get a handful of letters letters of support from the great and the good of your area. And forget about lots of directly expressed support from people who will actually form the bulk of your audience, because Ofcom is simply not interested. Elitism is alive and well and living at Riverside House in London, Ofcom's headquarters. Now finally, Section A, which asks you to demonstrate how you'll keep the station going for the full length of the licence period, 12 years. Forget for the moment that this question is comprehensively stupid, and it's enshrined in the legislation. Politicians and civil servants drew it up, remember. Who on earth in 2005 or 2006 can possibly have anything sensible to say about the way radio, even radio in small areas, is going to develop in 4 or 5 years, never mind 12? You're listening to this on a computer via the internet. Need I say more? So concentrate on how you say you'll keep your station viable for those 12 long years. Some of this I dealt with earlier when I was talking about the size and shape of your board, your shareholding and your income projections and so on. But here's the real trick which you must pull off if you want to beat your competition to the license. You have to say things which will leave Ofcom feeling that you have the best chance of being commercially successful. That's their main focus. Now you and all your competitors will be saying and doing roughly the same thing, because there's just so much you can say and promise. Your trick is to persuade Ofcom that your combination of promises is bigger, better, and more plausible than any of the others. So pull out all the stops here. And by this I mean take great care to show how you make those promises. The style is going to be much more important than the substance. Get some really smart marketing person to come up with a USP for you. And remember, please, what USP actually stands for. Unique selling proposition. It does not mean unique product property. It means that the way you sell your product has to be better than the way the competition sells theirs. Just like toothpaste, or washing powder, or petrol, where the products are 99% identical. It's how you say it that really matters. Now, several people have asked me a simple question. If I felt so strongly about the way the Cornwall license was awarded in the first place, why didn't I push the legal channels open to me as far as possible? Why did I take Ofcom on judicial review to the High Court, ask permission for a full judicial review, have that refused, and then drop the whole matter? Why didn't I appeal and keep on appealing until I'd exhausted every legal avenue? Easy enough to answer. Halfway through the day-long hearing in London, I passed a note to my wife. By the way, she and I, with some help from one of my sons, that was our entire legal team. We had no support from the company I'd formed 5 years previously. They took fright at the possibility of losing a court case and what that might cost them, and I can't blame them for that, not really. Ofcom and the other party, by the way, had herds of solicitors and barristers. What made the position very difficult for me was the fact that our big brother backer immediately put large amounts of distance between themselves and any suggestion of challenging Ofcom. And that didn't help my local directors to take matters further. Again, I can't blame either of them for that. Big crocs have to keep Ofcom sweet. And taking the regulator to court is considered dangerous. The big crocs have more fish to catch. So I took on the judicial review by myself. It was either a matter of accepting the atrociously perverse decision made in Cornwall by Ofcom, or fight it. I felt that I had no choice. I had to fight it. And I had no financial resources with which to buy lawyers. Lawyers only come in two price brackets, expensive and massively expensive. I couldn't afford either, so I went into the case as a litigant in person. But back to that note that I passed my wife. It said, "I think this judge has already made up his mind. He doesn't give any impression that he's listening to what I have to say." And so it turned out. Permission to proceed to a full and proper judicial review was refused by this judge without his taking even 5 minutes at the end of the hearing to think about it. He even went so far as to say, and this was both ridiculous and unjust, that the permission hearing had been as good as a full judicial review, and that I wouldn't be able to produce anything more in a full judicial review. Absolute nonsense. But, summary judgment, end of story. He behaved, I have to say, as though he had a pressing engagement elsewhere, and he devoted enough of his time to this case, and I left the courtroom wondering whether perhaps the English establishment had closed ranks when faced with the possibility of their bright, shiny new regulator, Ofcom, being trounced in court by a mere litigant in person, not even a proper lawyer. That could not be allowed to happen. Am I suggesting that in our democracy, where the judiciary is independent, that a judge could be got at to influence his decision? Good heavens, of course not. All I'm saying is that I presented the judge with several reasons why this award in Cornwall was an unreasonable one and a perverse one. But when his written judgment was handed down, it could be summed up as follows. Ofcom is the statutorily appointed regulator, and it can do what it pleases, unreasonable or not. Now go away. And here's a shedload of legal costs for you as well. If you want to appeal, go ahead. The bottom line is this. In judicial review cases in particular, judges say that they are reluctant to interfere with the workings and decision-making processes of a regulator appointed by Parliament. My view is that reluctance should not mean the same thing as refusal, and asking a court to assess whether a government body has acted reasonably is not the same thing as asking it to interfere. I said so in court. Was anyone listening? It didn't seem like it to me. So do you think I would, on the strength of all that, have stood the slightest chance of success on appeal? Did I want to put myself and my family through months and months more of this utterly awful and soul-destroying business of dealing with slimy lawyers and judges and courts, and having to do so by myself again, because having started out with no financial resources, I still had none? No, enough was enough. Oh, but what about legal aid, I hear you say? Sorry, not available in cases like this. So very reluctantly, I dropped the case. No one can beat the establishment when the establishment decides it's not going to be beaten. Let me mention the Ofcom bureaucrats and their relationship with the Radio Licensing Committee. The RLC, as it is known, is not what it ought to be, namely a group of people who really know how commercial radio works and who have the kind of experience and expertise which such a body ought to have right from day one. They are almost totally dependent on what the Ofcom bureaucrats tell them in what are called staff papers. These are documents prepared by the bureaucratic staff who've been given the job of assessing the applications, and you can take it from me, what the staff says goes. Ask Ofcom how many times the Radio Licensing Committee has gone against the recommendations of the staff in awarding licenses. I bet you they'll tell you it would not be in the public interest to provide that information. Did I hear you say Freedom of Information Act? Don't make me laugh. When it came to my preparing for the court case, there was a lot of information I wanted from Ofcom, and I made application in terms of that Freedom of Information Act. The answer on all but a few questions? This falls under exception clause, this, that, or the other, and in terms of those exceptions, we're not obliged to provide the information. Goodbye. So be warned, Ofcom, our bright, shiny, new, open and transparent regulator, is about as open as a closed clam and as transparent as mud. A slight digression there, but back to the bureaucrats. I don't think that one of the local of the radio licensing team has ever run a commercial radio station. Am I completely sure? No. And Ofcom will not release any information about them either. So I'll continue what I believe until I have proof to the contrary. The Ofcom radio licensing staff, by the way, have come from every media fringe you can think of, including press journalism and the old radio authority, but that's another story. However, they exercise the most awesome power. And however you do this, make sure that someone in your consortium gets to know everything they can about the people who will actually decide who gets that license. They make the decision. The Radio Licensing Committee simply rubber stamps it. Many people have asked me what I think will happen in Cornwall when the new station comes on the air. And shamefully, by the way, that will only happen about a year after the licence award. There will only be one winner in the battle for Cornwall audiences, BBC Radio Cornwall. It's already the number one station in Cornwall, has been for several years, and consistently beats Pirate FM into second place. And given that the new station will be going head-to-head with Pirate, targeting exactly the same audience as Pirate, the field will be open and clear for the BBC to increase its dominance down here. If Ofcom had deliberately set out to ensure that the BBC in Cornwall remained top radio dog, they could not have done a better job. A few years ago, I said in public that the way commercial radio licences are awarded in Britain stinks. I shouldn't have done that because it didn't help my cause at all, and it serves me right for telling things the way I see them. I was not behaving Englishly enough, but now I don't care, so let me say it again. The system stinks to high heaven. It's unfair, wasteful, cumbersome, far too slow, far too expensive, and much, much too steeped in bureaucracy, in protectionism, and frankly, it's borderline corrupt as well, in that peculiar British old boy way. Since 1973, when commercial radio came to mainland Britain, a grand total of 309 permanent commercial radio stations have been licensed, and that includes the national, regional, and local stations, the lot. That's in 33 years, give or take, an average of just over 9 new stations per year. In a country with a population now pushing 57 million, it's a disgrace. If you want a comparison, here's an exercise for you. Trace out the total area covered by FM and AM radio during daytime in Britain, and that means pretty much the whole of Britain. Using the same scale, superimpose that area on the eastern seaboard of the USA, with the outer eastern edge of the coverage area touching the Atlantic Ocean, but, and this is important, excluding the New York area, and then find out how many local radio stations are on the air in that area. Oh, let me save you the trouble. It's over 2,000, and this, I repeat, does not include New York. Population, about the same as Britain and Northern Ireland. How come? The answer is easy enough. Although the USA is now sadly becoming almost as bureaucratic as the UK, commercial radio in the USA has been for most of its life a bottom-upwards process. If you wanted to put a station on the air, and provided you could comply with some relatively simple conditions, you were given a license. If you failed, you failed, and either you handed the license back or you sold it on. Here in Britain, successive radio licensing regulators have wet themselves at the thought of giving a license to a group of people and then finding that, oops, they made a mistake and the station's going down the S-bend. That would make the regulator look bad. So the politicians and the lobbyists concocted the stupidly fail-safe system we now have in the UK. Here, licenses are handed down, and handed down very, very slowly, to licensee companies which have enough background cash to ensure that they cannot fail financially, even if they make operational losses year after year. It's radio licensing by subsidy, and it's ridiculous. Is it likely to change? Yes, it is, but not because government will bring that change about. It'll change because radio will stop being radio and become audio. You and I will be able to listen to what suits us best through our computers, our mobile phones, through podcasting, through our TV sets, via satellite with iPods, MP3 players, and who knows what new technical developments in the next few years. Traditional radio will be just one of the many methods of audio delivery. And given how tightly traditional commercial radio is regulated, it's going to struggle against competition it cannot handle. Not even digital radio is going to rescue it. So why would you even think, why did I even think, about trying to get a standard Common or Garden FM license from Ofcom? Because you have a lingering or even a newfound passion for old-fashioned radio with all its problems and despite everything that the future may hold. Frankly, commercial radio in the UK cannot even compete as it ought with the BBC. Despite 3 decades plus of existence and many more stations and the mighty BBC can manage, commercial radio still cannot get on even terms with the BBC, never mind overtaking it. Overall listening numbers to commercial radio still lag well behind the BBC, and at least part of that reason is sad but clear. British commercial radio, with a few exceptions, is bland, boring, repetitive, and for the most part in the hands of people whose interest is in money and more money. These radio barons keep telling everyone that most of the money they make, when they do make it, it goes back into improving the programming of the stations they control. Noble, very noble, unfortunately very seldom true in terms of operational profit. But what the hell, if they can make money out of operational profit, or rather if they can't, they look upon radio licenses as assets they can sell for stupidly massive capital gains. So they look to make their money that way, eventually. Some people who are not sympathetic to my views have thrown another question at me. Ofcom has awarded 17 commercial radio licenses since it started in December 2004. So why has it only been myself and Francis Wildman in Kent who've made such a fuss about losing and have taken Ofcom to court? Surely almost everyone is happy with the new regime? The answer is equally simple. The big radio crocodiles in the swamp are happy enough. They're not especially upset about losing. And remember that almost every commercial radio license is backed by a big radio croc. So even if the local consortium members are absolutely furious at having lost a license that they think they should have won, they'll be held back from taking things further by their big brother backers. That's what happened in Cornwall. But there are people like Francis and me, motivated by other things. When we lose to applicants who should never have won, we're heartbroken, we're despairing, and we're furious. Aside from Francis Wildman and myself, I know of at least two other applicants in small license areas to whom I've spoken personally, and one in a large market too. All of them disgusted and very, very angry. And that makes 5 out of 17, or nearly a third, of their awards where they left people feeling very angry, not just disappointed. There have to be winners and losers. I'm talking about seriously angry. There may indeed be more. Those I've spoken to feel as I do, and as Francis does, but they lack just that last bit of fury that gives them the courage to challenge the regulator. The fact that I was brushed aside by the High Court doesn't help either. Who is ever going to challenge Ofcom unless they're very, very rich and very, very courageous? Which is sad, because if there were enough challenges, even the establishment would have to take note and force a rethink about the legislation and the regulator charged with implementing it. A good start, incidentally, would be to legislate a proper appeals procedure, whereby failed applicants who believe there's been a serious miscarriage of justice and maladministration by Ofcom can apply to have the decision reviewed by an independent panel of acknowledged radio experts without the terrible and expensive business of having to go to the High Court. Competition for a radio license is sometimes described as a beauty contest, and the way you're supposed to demonstrate your beauty is to have better responses to the regulator's questions and to be more thorough in answering them. But sadly, in too many cases, the ugly entrant is winning the prize. So be warned, Ofcom does not assess applications by any consistent series of objective tests. It says it does, but in fact the evidence suggests that it's influenced by who knows whom, who's lunched whom, who has the bigger pockets, who can do the better job of blinding this regulator with purple prose, fancy illustrations and research, research, research. One final thought. Local commercial radio is not the place to be if you want to make a lot of money. It has to be a business, yes, and it's got to be viable, but the people who are attracted to this unique medium are those who are in love with it, truly passionate about it. Unfortunately, Ofcom doesn't seem to see things that way. They're focused on the financial aspects of local radio to an extent which will stultify and sanitize the industry even beyond where it is now. They're getting the balance wrong, and they're treating radio as if it were a series of factories producing furniture or electrical goods. Radio just isn't like that. Here's a core problem. When people have a new business idea, especially if it's going to be a small business, generally they don't have to put themselves up for judgment by others to whom they wouldn't give the time of day. They've got to comply with planning and health and safety requirements and that sort of stuff, of course, but for the most part they don't need a license from a regulator in order to get their business going. They make a success of it by just doing it, taking the normal commercial risks and taking the consequences if they fail. But in my case, and in the case of many like me, who've not merely worked in commercial radio all our lives, but have lived it, breathed it, eaten it, drunk it, slept it, and loved it, we've always had to bang our heads against the deadly wall of regulation. We just don't have the luxury of starting a business without having to go on bended knees before some very arrogant and not terribly expert bureaucrats who have the power of business life or death in their hands. There are some very wise words that are credited to one of the ancients. Select with care those by whom you would be judged. Sadly, there's no choice open to you when you decide you want to create a new local commercial radio license. You have to deal with Ofcom. And now you know how I feel about that. If you're interested, the text of this talk has been posted to a website at www.celticaradio.com/comment. I'll say it again, www.celticaradio.com/comment. And you can read it there. And you can email comments to me at john@celticaradio.com. That's john@celticaradio.com. This is John Grierson. Thank you for listening.